From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
In his new book, Wild Plant Culture, restoration ecologist Jared Rosenbaum says something provocative about gardening with native plants. It's time to expand our vision past supporting birds, butterflies, and bees, and fully integrate the most challenging animal of all, the human being, into our native plant gardens, he says. So what all would that mean, and how do we do that? More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Jared Rosenbaum is a botanist and restoration ecologist, and he's also co-owner with his wife, Rachel Macko, of Wild Ridge Plants Mail Order Nursery in New Jersey. His new book, Wild Plant Culture, A Guide to Restoring Edible and Medicinal Native Plant Communities, is out this month. Welcome, Jared. I'm so glad to get to talk to each other.
Hi, Margaret. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yes, and we'll have a book giveaway with the transcript of this show over on awaytogarden.com, which I've been reading and enjoying. And before we begin talking about that, I wanted to just hear a little bit about Wild Ridge Plants and what else you're up to when you're not writing books.
Sure. So we're a native plant nursery. We're in north central New Jersey. We grow native plant species from seed that we collect in local natural areas. And we have a bit of a focus on forest understory herbs and upland meadow plants, and also have always had a strong interest in those plants that have a long cultural relationship with people. So edible native plants, medicinal native plants, and those used in various crafts as well.
Yeah, I will maybe touch on some of these later on in the discussion, and I'll put some with the transcript of the show. You have some videos that you've done speaking about those very old relationships of plants with a place, and really wonderful YouTube videos, a series of those. So I want to definitely shout those out. So tell us what ecological, sort of the short version of what ecological restoration is, because that might sound different to gardeners listening.
I work as a field botanist. In addition to collecting seed and propagating plants here at Wild Ridge, and the short version of my job is to, you know, go out and make lists of plants that I see. So I'm often working in county parks, nature preserves, and I don't think that's really my job. I think what my job is to observe the plant life at a given site and to come up with a narrative about it. So to look at the health, diversity, and abundance of the different wild plant species there and try to figure out, why are these plants here? Or why are they thriving? Or, as is so often the case, why are they not thriving? Or why do I know that this community here could have other species too, but it doesn't? And piecing together that story from field clues, whether it's looking directly at the plant species there or sometimes just at their form, like, oh, why are all the oak trees here double trunked?
Oh,
putting together those stories is a really interesting process for me. And I have to admit that I'm telling the same story over and over again, and I'm seeing the same woods over and over again as I do botanical survey work. Woods that I know, gosh, this place must have been so beautiful X amount of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can tell by the couple remnant, you know, hepaticas here that are flowering, or the little browse black cohosh, that there could be so much other cool stuff here too. But I know that there are elements of that natural area, of that plant community, that are missing. And so for me, ecological restoration is thinking about the story of the place, thinking about how that story may have been sort of truncated or degraded in the past so that it's not at its full expression, and thinking about how we human beings can fit back into that story. So if there's plants missing from that community, what are the missing elements here? And sometimes they're disturbances, like wildfire. And sometimes they're missing animal species like large carnivores. But what I keep coming around to when I'm doing field work is that one of the most important missing elements of these plant communities is actually us, people. And so when I wrote the book, my idea was, how do we reintegrate ourselves into communities? And communities mean a bunch of different things. You know, we're always thinking about creating community. It sounds really good, but there's a lot of interdependency in communities. You know, there's a lot of I need you and you need me, and it's sort of inextricable in some ways. And when I think about plant communities on this continent, and I think about their story, I also think of a deeper story, which is the relationship for thousands of years that indigenous people had with these plant communities. And these were relationships that involved harvest, and they involved tending also. And I think we have a much different idea now of the kind of ecological relationship that indigenous people had with wild plant communities throughout the Americas. And one of the really cool things that's coming out of archaeology right now is the extent to which even those wild areas that we think of as like paragons of wildness, like the Amazon, are actually created by this relationship of human beings and their food plants and their medicine plants and their craft plants.
Right.
And that places, you know, maybe it's the California coast or maybe it's the Smokies. All these places actually had a very strong human presence, the way you might say that they had a strong presence of, you know, wolves or beaver or deer, that we are animals in this ecosystem. And we got into this idea that we really live in this almost separate parallel existence.
Yeah. Look where that got us, Jared.
Look where that got us. Yeah. So one of the things that reaches out to me and is like so fascinating and fun and also a deep connection is using these plants for food again. You know, these are amazing, delicious, highly nutritive foods that people relied on for thousands of years on this continent. And we can link ourselves in this sort of like deep emotional way of reliance on our native plant species if they can become our sustenance again.
And one of the things about sort of the, I hate to use a word like useful, because that's obviously not what I mean, because they're useful in such deeper ways, but the plants that we could utilize as foodstuffs or medicines or whatever, or as you say, in crafting, you know, that, so for instance, in the spring, wild ramps is probably the most popular example, besides some of the mushrooms and so forth. And, you know, and so where I am, rural New York State, Hudson Valley, you know, everybody goes into the woods and takes all the wild ramps, and, you know, and that worries me. And so, you know, you sort of are advocating a little more about, we could actually grow them if we understood how, right? And there's not necessarily, maybe there is for ramps, but for a lot of these native plants, there's not a manual, you know, they're not in the plant horticulture books that tell you how to grow this, you know, and so inspired by reading, you know, your book, dig into your book, I sort of try to take a mental tour around my garden of the native plants and filter which ones were edible or medicinal or that I thought were, and I bet many more are that I don't even know, but like golden seal, for instance, one of my favorite woodland plants in the garden for a million years here that I have been growing, Hydrastis canadensis. I mean, so that's one, for instance, and I used to grow Jerusalem artichoke, and I have a lot of Aurelia racemosa, the spikenard, the native spikenard, and, you know, and on and on and on. So I thought maybe we could talk about some of the plants that, you know, maybe surprisingly to people, you know, aronias, elderberries, blueberries. You had a beautiful video on YouTube a while back about black cohosh, Actea racemosa, and I don't really know what it's, what is it used for, like a medicinal purpose or something, but that's an incredible plant.
So we have this sort of trio of, I think, you know, medicinal plants of worldwide repute in our kind of like Appalachian or highlands, upland forests, the ginseng, golden seal, black cohosh. And these are extremely highly regarded medicinal plants and also under a lot of pressure from over-harvesting for yes. medicinal herbs industry. And the alternative to medicinal herbs industry is, you know, people growing things themselves and being able to utilize plants from their garden for healing and for food and taking pressure off of these remaining wild populations by figuring out how can we grow this in, you know, potentially our backyard or our garden. And here's the interesting thing about that, though, is all of us have different situations where we live. You know, where we live was a habitat at one point, and some people still have like a really nice woodlot in their backyard, and other people's backyard is asphalt. And so what we garden is really going to depend on where we are. And I think that this is one of the interesting things that the native plant movement is kind of injecting into gardening, which is, as we think about how can we support the natural world with our gardens, like how can we support declining bird and pollinator populations, our gardens start to kind of ooch outward and get bigger, and they become almost like ecological restorations at the scale of the schoolyard or yes. the lawn or the backyard. And I think we start asking ourselves a different question when we scale up in that way. So in our classic garden, we're creating on a fairly small scale, usually, conditions that are so nice and so posh and so ideal, and trying to create them for the plants that we're going to put in there. You know, whether they're tomatoes or it's a rock garden.
Right.
With scaling up to more like a restoration, even if it isn't our yard, we ask a different set of questions, which is, what are the conditions in my yard or my farm or, you know, the you know, woods behind the school or whatever it is, but what are the conditions on my site and what kind of plants are already really well suited to those? So, you know, if we're taking a lawn and converting it to native plants, we're not necessarily thinking about your ginsengs and golden seals and black cohoshes, but we might be thinking about milkweeds and wild bergamot and wild strawberry and maybe some bayberry. And those plants are also medicinal and edible. So part of what the book is doing is, you know, matching plants to places by talking about this idea of the plant community and talking about all the different plant habitats that we have in our area, and also matching people to plants. Mm. So what's going to fit in your site that you might not have to utterly transform your site to be able to host?
Right.
And for some people, that will be ramps. We've actually had really good experience here just seeding in ramps in a variety of places that I never thought they would grow. And so here's a plant that, you know, we largely see in nice older woods. So we're talking about Allium trichocum or leeks, wild leeks or ramps.
Yes.
Here's a plant that we, you know, largely see on kind of nice, fertile stream sides, floodplains, and so on in older woods. It's also a plant that has these little shiny black seeds that are like tiny marbles, and they don't fly in the wind, you know, and they're not a berry that a bird is going to eat and deposit right. 10 miles away.
Right.
They're kind of dispersal limited other than maybe moving downstream. And what we're discovering is just because there's not a lot of ramps around doesn't mean that there couldn't be a lot of ramps.
Yes.
They need a partner, right? They need a helper. They're not crossing Route 95 on their own anytime soon. But all these young feral woodlots that we have that were farms back in the 50s or earlier, all these kind of abandoned landscapes that are rewilding as best they can, these are places where plants like ramps could grow, but they need us to be a member of the community again. They need our transportation skills. They need our human smarts. And part of saying, oh, we should eat ramps more is saying, instead of just digging them up and selling them at, you know, like the Union Square Market.
Oh, yeah, for $1 million.
How can we learn what these plants really need
right.
and harvest some of those seeds every fall and bring them to another suitable habitat and understand their habitat and understand them well enough to know what that is? So I think there's this whole process of discovery here. There's discovering this really delicious gourmet food, And then there's discovering the personality of somebody else in our community. In this case, a plant being in our community that needs our help.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I mean, you're really on the ground, hands-on, learning this. And part is from drawing inferences, as you say, about where you might see it growing naturally and so forth. And the life history of the plant, how it grows and where it grows and so forth. Some of the others, like you write about in the book, you include a passage on something I have a lot of, which is wild ginger, Acerum canadense. Does that have we have the word ginger in the common name, but it's not a true ginger as in the ginger root. How does that fit in?
So wild ginger is a little bit complicated. Wild ginger has a long history of use as an edible plant. But it also is part of a plant family that has some potentially toxic elements to it. And it's, you know, one of these plants sort of like sassafras that people go back and forth on because there's some science saying one thing. And then there's just a lot of things that we don't know. So where I've landed on wild ginger, but I think that everybody should do their own research, is that the potentially toxic elements, or in this case, potentially carcinogenic elements, do not seem to be water-soluble plant chemicals. So I will use wild ginger in a tea, and it has the most amazing aroma. I mean, even if you go out and you have wild ginger in your garden and you just go and kind of scratch and break a root a little bit, well, the rhizome really, it's so spicy and it's so good. It's one of my favorite wild aromas out there. But right now I'm not chopping it into my stir fry.
No. I get what you mean. Right.
So sometimes, you know, one of the things that people think about when they think about wild edibles is toxicity, or is this plant going to kill me or whatever. And I really like that, because I think that makes you a really good botanist. Because if you're looking at something, you're like, this could be a really bad decision, I better check my ID again. That's what gets people really looking at the leaves and smelling the foliage and touching the little fine hairs on the top and so on. And, but the other thing is, oftentimes toxicity is a matter of preparation or use. So if I hand you a raw potato, Margaret, I'm like, you know, millions of people, billions of people all over the world eat these, and you chomp into it, you're going to look at me with pure hate in your eyes.
Yes.
Raw potato is not French fries, but we know how to make French fries, and they're so good. And that's so often the case with these wild edibles too, is that they have a cultural tradition of preparation around them that makes them not only safe to eat, but also delicious. And we have to, you know, in some cases, innovate or relearn those things about all these species. And that's also part of the excitement.
Right. So two of the things I think about when you're talking about that are two that are, they're edible, quote unquote, but not at the wrong time and not in the wrong condition or whatever, like two fall fruits, you know, that I have a lot of both in the garden, the aronias, which the word chokeberry, they call it choke. Because is that an astringent fruit? And even the elderberries, the timing is everything with the elderberries, right? Even as common as that is, and you see the birds going wild on it, but for us, it's a useful plant, but timing is everything. So again, you have to do your homework, you have to become intimately knowledgeable, study these creatures, not only to ID them, but to potentially engage with them in terms of using them in any way.
Every year I'm tasting the chokeberries. I'm like, are you ready yet? I'm like, no, because it has that astringency. And it's the same thing with one of my favorite native fruits, really the plant that kind of brought me into all this in the first place, which is American persimmon. So, you know, back when I was a city kid and had just moved to a kind of moldy cottage and, you know, on the side of a marsh, I was starting to get drawn into plants a little bit. And then I found these little, you know, very small kind of sassafras-like trees on the edge of the meadow, and they had these orange fruits on them. What could this be? I mean, I had no idea. And I don't remember exactly how I figured it out, but we had a couple of field guides kicking around, and I figured out that they were wild native persimmons. And I had, you know, no idea that such a thing existed.
Yes.
And these are fruits that, you know, when they look really good, like a beautiful, shiny kind of orange apple, do not eat them. You know, they're hard and they're super astringent. They're going to pucker up your tongue in a horrible way.
Yes.
But when they're all gushy and kind of black and maybe they're lying on the snow after the first snowfall, they're like, you know, they're nectar of the gods. They're just incredible. They're so sweet and, you know, with such an exotic flavor. And that's another plant that I've talked to people who have been super deterred from because they tried it at the wrong time. But if you get it when it's really ripe, it's an incredible flavor.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few more I just want to ask you about in the last few minutes, just because, for instance, I just have been enjoying not just the book, but also some of your YouTube videos. And again, I'll give the link to those. You did one about bee balm, which is a plant, you know, the red bee balm, the red Monarda.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't know, for instance, that it was, you say in New Jersey, where you are and where you do a lot of your field work, it's not a common plant, and yet it's such a common garden plant. It's often a beginner's, I call it a confidence booster, you know, because it sort of spreads and grows and makes you think you're a great gardener, but it's not a common plant. So there's also some, and I don't know what types of medicinal herbal qualities it has or doesn't have, but that was an interesting one too. And groundnut, Apios, you know, is just another really beautiful, wonderful plant that I don't think people grow. So I just wondered if maybe a couple of those, if you wanted to tell us about them, a little bit about them quickly.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would do with bee balm is when it's in flower, pluck off some of those flowers and just eat them whole. And they have kind of a sugary nectar reward at the base of them because they're a hummingbird plant.
Yeah.
But that's mixed with this, you know, so all of Monarda have this kind of overtone of thyme or oregano. They're in the mint family. They have a lot of allied phytochemicals with some of our culinary mints that we use. So you could certainly use them, you know, sprinkle it on your pizza or whatever. But the flowers have like this little bit of sweet, this little bit of citrus, maybe a tiny bit of rose, and then this oregano thyme overtone. And it's so good. And just think about, you know, just sprinkle that as a garnish on your salad or something.
Huh, and beautiful. Really, that would be beautiful. Yeah.
And be gorgeous, right?
Yeah. So the hummingbirds are onto something, huh?
So the hummingbirds have a sweet tooth, as we know, right? Because they all feed on sugar water. And those plants with those long red tubular corollas that the hummingbird bill fits into perfectly tend to have sugar at the base of them. So, you know, people can decide what they feel safe trying, but we also nibble on columbine flowers and even the coral honeysuckle flowers, which I've never really read as being edible anywhere else. But my son, who's 11, will go out and just chomp on those because they're sweet.
Yeah. And the quick, just the last minute, just the groundnut, because that's one that I don't think people try. The Apios.
Yeah, groundnut has these tubers underground, and they're kind of like a mix between potatoes and, let's say, chickpeas, because they're a legume. And what I'll do is I'll fry them up in a skillet, and the outside skin actually gets super crispy, and I liken them to like a gourmet tater tot, because they have a starchy inside, but the outside gets like super crispy and flaky. And they are one of those really good staple foods that were widely transported and tended by indigenous peoples, are probably found through, you know, a lot more, with a lot more frequency in the landscape. And that if we're considering, like, you know, what's going to be our quote unquote meat and potatoes on a native plant diet, like what's really going to last us through the day, that's a great fundamental and really tasty. So that's Apios americana, the ground.
Yeah. Well, Wild Plant Culture is the book, and we've been talking with Jared Rosenbaum, the author of it, and co-owner of the Wild Ridge Plants Mallard Nursery in New Jersey, and lots more stuff, great YouTube videos. So I'm so glad you made the time today, and I hope we'll talk again soon, Jared. Thank you.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.